Hare Krishna, welcome to today's Srimad Bhagavatam class. Om Namo Bhagavate Vasudevaya.
Om Namo Bhagavate Vasudevaya.
Om Namo Bhagavate Vasudevaya. Narayana namaskritya, Taram chaiva narottamam, Devim sarasvatim vyasam, Tato jayam adhirayet, Nasta praishu abhadreshu, Nityam bhagavata sevaya, Bhagavatir tamashloke, Bhaktir Bhavati Naishtiki. So before I begin, I'd like to first ask the blessings of all the assembled Vaishnavas and all those who are listening online. Please bless me that I can say something which is relevant and purifying for myself and for inspiring to all of you. Thank you very much. So today we're reading from Canto 12. Chapter 12, text 12 and 13. So we'll do 12 together. Please repeat. Shatarupa chayastrinam.
Shatarupa chayastrinam.
Adya prakritir uttama. Santano Dharma Patninam.
Santano Dharma Patninam.
Kardamasya Prajapate.
Kardamasya Prajapate.
Shatarupa Chayastrinam.
Shatarupa Chayastrinam.
Adya Prakritir Uttama.
Adya Prakritir Uttama.
Santano Dharma Patninam.
Santano Dharma
Kardamasya Prajapate.
Kardamasya Prajapate.
Shatarupa Chayastrinam.
Shatarupa Chayastrinam.
Adya Prakritir Uttama.
Adya Prakritir Uttama.
Santano Dharma Patninam.
Santano Dharma Patninam.
Kardamasya Prajapate.
Kardamasya Prajapate. Thank you. So word for word. Shatarupa. Shatarupa.
Shatarupa.
Cha.
And. Ya.
Who.
Strinam.
Of women.
Adya.
The first.
Prakriti.
The consort.
Uttama.
Best.
Santanaha.
The progeny.
Dharmapatninam.
Of the pious wives.
Kardamasya.
Of the sage Kardama.
Prajapate.
The progenitor.
Translation. Also related are the appearance of the first woman, Shatarupa, who was the excellent consort of Manu and the offspring of the pious wives of Prajapati Kardama. Now I'll go on to text 13. I'll just say the Sanskrit myself here. Avataro Bhagavata Kapilasya Mahatmanaha Devahutyasya Samvada Kapilena Chadimata. Translation. The Bhagavatam describes the incarnation of the Supreme Personality of Godhead as the exalted sage Kapila and records the conversation between that greatly learned soul and his mother, Devahuti. Yeah. No purports, so we'll just try to speak something on these. Om Gyanatimirandasya Gyananjana Shalakaya Chakshurun Militandena Tasmai Shri Gurave Namaha Shri Chaitanya Manovishtam Stapitam Dena Bhutale Swayam Rupa Kadamayam Dadati Swaparantikam Vandeham Shri Gurum Shri Yuta Padakamalam Shri Gurum Vaishnavamscha Shri Rupam Sakrajatam Sahagana Raghunatham Vitam Tam Sajivam Sadvitam Savadutam Parijana Sahitam Krishna Chaitanya Devam Shri Radha Krishna Padam Sahagana Lalita Shri Vishakam Vitamscha Hey Krishna Karuna Sindhu Dina Bandhu Jagatpate Gopesha Gopika Kanta Radha Kanta Namostite Sapta Kanchana Gaurangi Radhe Vrindavanishvari Vrishabhanu Suti Devi Pranamami Hari Priye Panchakalpa Tirubhyascha Kripa Sindhubhya Evacha Patitanam Pavanebhyo Vaishnavebhyo Namo Namaha Jaya Shri Krishna Chaitanya Prabhu Nityananda Shri Advaita Gadadhara Srivasadi Gaura Bhakta Vrinda Hare Krishna, Hare Krishna, Krishna Krishna, Hare 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 Rama, Hare Rama, Rama Rama, Hare Hare. So this chapter is the Srimad Bhagavatam summarized, and that's part of the reason why in this chapter there are hardly any purports. When I first got the verses, I was thinking, wait a minute, there's no purport. Shouldn't I read until I get to a purport? But if I was going to do that, I would read the whole chapter, and still no purport. So it's like this. But in preparation for this class, what I did was I went back to the third canto, where there are plenty of purports, and I combed through many of those verses and purports to try to bring out some points which are relevant to the verses here and for us as practicing devotees. So in text 12, it talks about Shatarupa as being the first woman. The Sanskrit is Strinam Adya. So she is the Adi means the beginning or the origin. So she's the first woman. And it struck me as interesting because when we read the description of the creation prior to the appearance of Shatarupa and Swayambhuva Manu, there are women there. For example, there's the Rudras are created, and then there are the 11 Rudranis, or the wives of Rudra. And then there's also the daughter of Brahma, Vak, who we'll talk about a little more later. But there's a sense in which Shatarupa is quite distinct from these other women, in a very interesting way, because at the beginning of creation, Brahma, he had what Prabhupada calls it as a transcendental body. He had a subtle body. And the first things that he created in the material world were actually qualities, like false ego, self-deception, anger after frustration and a false sense of proprietorship. So a lot of sort of negative qualities, because after all, it's the material world, and it has to, you know, in order for the souls who desire to enjoy themselves separately from Krishna to have a material experience, then there needs to be these things. So Brahma, as a part of a duty, which he probably didn't enjoy much, he created these qualities in the material world. But after it's described that he felt bad about doing that, he looked back on his work and he thought, oh my God, what terrible thing have I done? You know, as a devotee, you don't want to, you know, create false ego. You want to try to destroy those things. But anyways, that was his service. So he thought, well, let me do something good for the world. So he meditated on the Lord, and then after that, he created, first of all, the four Kumaras, and Narada Muni, Rudra, and all these sages, you know, like Kardama, Atri Muni, Vashisht, Bhrigu, Daksha, all of these great personalities who were powerful munis, born of Brahma's transcendental body. And they were born in unconventional ways. They just kind of, there was no, you know, sexual reproduction as we know it, but they just kind of came out of different parts of Lord Brahma's body or aspects of his existence. So, you know, one comes from Brahma's thumb, another from his eyes, another from his shadow, another from his determination, another from his mind, another from his ears. So they just kind of, these great personalities just come shooting out of different parts of Lord Brahma's body. And in this way, Lord Brahma was beginning to populate the universe. But there was a little bit of an obstacle in that those personalities who were created in that way, Brahma wanted that they continue this process of procreation, but most of them were not willing to do so. As we know, the Kumaras flatly refused to even, you know, develop to adulthood because they didn't want to be involved in procreation. Narada Muni was also, you know, that's not for me. I want you to stay nice, sticky brahmachari. And, of course, Rudra, well, tried, but his children turned out to be more harm than good, and that they were, you know, the descendants of, because Rudra is like anger. Rudra appeared due to the anger of Lord Brahma, out of frustration that the Kumaras refused to reproduce. And so these descendants of Rudra were very angry and violent and destructive, and they were just destroying whatever Brahma had just created. So that was problematic. And so Brahma was kind of frustrated. He was really feeling despondent. Like sometimes if you're trying to do a service, you've been ordered by your spiritual master to do something, and you're trying your best to do it, and it's just not happening. It's just, you know, you're just failing. Everything's being blocked. And then you can become frustrated, and then you have to think of another way to do it. Or you might pray to the Lord for some inspiration. How can I achieve? How can I fulfill the order of my spiritual master? So Brahma was in this state of consciousness, and at that time, it's very interesting because he was actually the inspiration, you could say, came in the form of lust. So at that time, when he's frustrated and because he's not able to perform his duties properly in his service to the Lord, he became overcome by sexual attraction to his own daughter. And he began to pursue his daughter with the desire to sexually enjoy her, which of course is very abominable by any, you know, moral standards. So he kind of just lost it, you know, and he was running after, and then his son Marichi said, wait a minute, what's, you know, very respectfully, he said, this has never been done before, this is unprecedented, you know, this is, you know, not what you should be doing. Please reflect on what's going on and how this is going to affect you and everything. So he checked himself. But he was so ashamed that he changed his body. He gave up that body. So he gave up his body, but because his consciousness had been focused on sex enjoyment, then, as we know, the consciousness of our subtle bodies carry us into our next body. So in the same way, Lord Brahma's consciousness determined that he would get a different kind of body. So he no longer had a transcendental body, but he had a body which, as is described there, is allowed to be connected with sex. That's literally what it says. It's allowed to be connected with sex. So that body was different, and that body was equipped with both male and female reproductive capacities, which sounds kind of funny, but you'll see how this develops. And that's why in the previous verse, I don't know if whoever spoke yesterday mentioned this, but it's described in that verse that Lord Brahma is the Adha Nari Ishvara, which means, do you remember this from yesterday? It says that Swayambhuva appeared from the half-man, half-woman Ishvara. Was it spoken about?
No.
No, okay. So I read this when I was preparing for the class. I kind of read that. I was like, what? Half-man, half-woman Ishvara? Who's that? So that's actually Brahma, and he was considered Ardha Nari, half-woman, because he had this potential for, you know, the female reproductive, female, you know, reproduction. So what happened was that from that body that was half, had the potential, potentially half-man, half-woman, it actually expanded and separated into two different forms, which were Swayambhuva Manu and Shatarupa. One had a mustache and the other had breasts. And so there, that's why Shatarupa and Manu are not considered the sons and son and daughter of Brahma, but they're actually, the Sanskrit word used is kayam, which means body. They're actually his body. Their expansion of his body expanded into another body, split into two pieces, and there you have Shatarupa and Swayambhuva Manu. And because they were created for this purpose, and because they were created with a consciousness of sex life, the first thing they did, but I mean, they were born mature adults, and the first thing they did was unite sexually. And they produced, of course, Brahma was very happy because he's like, okay, now we're going to get children and we're going to get progeny. And they produced amazing children. Their children were Uttanapad, Priyavrata, Devahuti, Akuti, and Prasuti, who were all powerful and amazing transcendental personalities. So, and they grew up and entered Grihastha Ashram, and they developed a dynasty through their activities. So we can see how this inglorious act or consciousness of Lord Brahma had glorious results in the service of the Lord. So I found this very interesting. And it's actually this pastime of Brahma chasing after his daughter. Maitreya mentions it to Vidura with great hesitation. It's something that he doesn't really want to talk about because, you know, a great devotee doesn't really like to talk about something that disgraceful activities of another devotee. But he did so because it happened for a purpose. And actually, this purpose had two dimensions. So one dimension was that it's instructive. So we can learn from this, you know, apparent fall down of Brahma, the danger of association with the opposite sex. That the scriptures say that even one shouldn't be alone in a room with even one's mother, daughter, sister. So the desire for sexual enjoyment is so strong and so overwhelming that even a great personality like Lord Brahma can get carried away, what to speak of us. The other instruction is that in the purports in that section is mentioned that this Brahma, this incident happened before the Bhagavatam was spoken, because it couldn't have possibly happened after the Bhagavatam was spoken, because if Brahma had heard the Bhagavatam, it could have never happened. So what we can learn from that is that what's going to save us from the pitfall of falling down in illicit sex is hearing the Bhagavatam. So therefore, Nityam Bhagavata Sevaya. We have to hear this Bhagavatam regularly, every day. And it will protect us from those types of things. But the other purpose was this, that it was actually this, what we could see as sinful activity of Brahma was actually instrumental in him doing his service. Isn't that interesting? I found it so interesting. And it's also relevant for us, because in the society of devotees, well, let's see, before we go there, let's look at how this wasn't a singular incident in the scriptures. There's actually many times where Krishna puts his pure devotees and even his eternal associates, he induces them to do things which look really bad, which may be sinful or which may be against the principles of devotional service or maybe contrary to morality. But he does so to achieve his own purpose. Because the only reason Brahma wanted to populate the universe was because Krishna wanted him to do so, because Krishna wanted this, needed a material world so that souls could be into it, so could, you know, go through what they had to go through, and so souls had to be in it. So it was Krishna's purpose. And if we look at, for example, Arjuna, it's another example, in the Battle of Kurukshetra. He was bewildered in the performance of his duty, and he outright refused to fight. And Krishna says right there to Arjuna, he says, actually to decline to do your prescribed duty is sinful. Yet Krishna engaged his pure devotee and friend Arjuna in sinful activity for the purpose of speaking the Bhagavad Gita, because Krishna wanted the Bhagavad Gita to be spoken. Similarly, Maharaj Parikshit, he was a pure devotee. Krishna protected him in the womb. Yet he committed a great offense of throwing a dead snake on a great sage who was meditating. Like, imagine you're sitting down, you're chanting your japa, you're completely absorbed in your japa, and somebody just comes and throws a dead snake on you. You know, you'd be offended, right? You'd be like, what the hell are you doing? So, and it was totally out of character for Maharaj Parikshit to do so, because he was a pure soul, he was a gentle soul, he was a religious person. For him, you know, he would worship such a personality as Shamika Amuni, a great Brahmin. So why did he do this? Because Krishna wanted this whole drama to happen so that the Bhagavatam could be spoken. So again, Krishna uses his devotee in a way which is not really good behavior for the devotee, but it's for Krishna to fulfill his own purpose. Another example is Yudhisthira. So Yudhisthira got involved in the dice game, and he became completely compulsive in gambling. He lost it. And, I mean, gambling is allowed for kshatriyas, but the extent to which he got carried away in that dice game was just completely, you know, shameful. Yet, if that hadn't happened, then all the events that unfolded from that wouldn't have happened. And, you know, Krishna's mission of killing all the demons in the Battle of Kurukshetra might not have happened. So it was for Krishna's own purpose. And then there's the Yadu dynasty. So the Yadu dynasty, they were Krishna's direct descendants. They were born from Krishna's own blood, if you can call it that, although Krishna doesn't have veins, but, you know, they were his relatives. And they went and just got completely plastered. They got drunk drinking rice wine, became angry, and killed each other. So what is that? What kind of behavior is that? But Krishna had to make them do that because it's the only way he could get them to go back to the spiritual world, you know, to otherwise they would have been a burden on the earth. So Krishna just made them do that. So what I would like you to consider is that in the society of devotees, we often observe devotees doing things that look kind of outrageous, immoral, or even sinful. And while those activities may be complete maya, and often are, and while we certainly shouldn't use this reasoning in order to justify our own nonsense, but we can't eliminate it as a possibility that it may be Krishna's arrangement. It may be part of Krishna's plan that the devotee do this either for their own purification, for their own spiritual advancement, or in order to move the society, ISKCON as a society, to move our movement into a certain direction that he wants it to go to. And that by this happening, it's going to draw devotees' attention to a need or a problem which needs to be addressed. That's something that we can consider. And in terms of things, sometimes devotees just need to go through something. And it's not necessarily, although it may look bad, it may look disgraceful, it may be shameful, but it may actually be for the ultimate good of the devotee. And it often is, if we just kind of like give it time and see how it turns out. It usually ends up being the best thing that could have happened to that devotee, in retrospect. Because if you think about it, we've been in this material world for so many lifetimes, countless lifetimes, doing all kinds of nonsense, and developing, you know, we've got so many layers of conditioning over our consciousness, we've got all these anarthas, attachments. And then when we come to Krishna consciousness, we have this short Kali Yuga lifespan of 100 years maximum. And most of us, by the time we come to Krishna consciousness, we've already wasted 25% of that just kind of growing up, right? And so Krishna's only got a few decades in order to purify us of millions of lifetimes of contamination. And so to do that, sometimes he has to put us into extreme situations. And it's interesting that he does it. This is Krishna's purpose. The whole purpose of the material world is to get us out of it, is to get us back to Godhead. And when a sincere soul approaches the Lord and surrenders to him and says, Krishna, I don't want to stay in this material world enjoying my senses in ignorance anymore. I want to go to the spiritual world and serve you. Then Krishna's got a big job on his hands. And it's said that he actually takes charge of this cleaning. This is stated in the Bhagavatam, 1:2:17. Where it says, Srimvatam Swakata Krishna Punya Shravana Kirtanam Hridyantasto Yabhadrani Vidunoti Suritsatam. That Sri Krishna, the personality of Godhead, who is seated in the heart of all living entities and is the benefactor of the truthful devotee, he cleanses the desire for material enjoyment from the heart of those devotees who have developed the urge to hear his messages, which are in themselves virtuous when properly heard and chanted. So Krishna is doing the cleaning, and he's going to do it his way. It's like, I recently heard a class this last Sunday. Hridayananda Maharaj gave a class, and he was speaking on that series of verses from 1:2:16 to 1:2:19 or something. And specifically in regard to this one, Sri Vrindavasvakata Krishna, he says that, he uses analogy, which I thought was interesting. He says it's like an automatic car wash. You drive your car up to the car wash, you know, you put your money in there, press the button, and you have to roll up all the windows, you disengage the clutch, put it in neutral, take off the parking brake, and you just sit there. You're not doing anything, you're just sitting in the car, and then all of a sudden these, you know, scrubbing brushes descend on you, and they press down on the car, and they're scrubbing it, and then these hoses are injecting water and soap, and it's all happening, and the machine actually like pulls your car through it. And you don't have any, you're not doing it. The machine is just doing it all. You're just a passive observer of the process. So in the same way, Krishna purifies our hearts And we don't always have control over how that purification is happening. But Krishna holds us into situations which he knows are going to catalyze the purification, because it needs to be catalyzed, because it has to happen fast. In a few short times, we've got to purify us of all this stuff. So, yeah, so some things, sometimes that situation may look weird. You know, it may be just very wacky. Like, this last Sunday when I was at the Sunday feast here, I was speaking with one devotee, and she was telling me about one godbrother who, you know, she's saying, do you know what he did? You know, he did this, and he did that, and he was living like this, and then he did that, and it was all like these really nefarious, really, you know, egregious kind of activities. And I was just like, I said, at first I was like, yeah, I remember he was doing this, and he was doing that, and he was living like this, and it was really like, you know, appalling. And then I kind of reflected on it, and I thought, well, you know, sometimes we have to just see these things as Krishna's transcendental pastimes. Because afterwards I was thinking about that very devotee that we were, you know, kind of criticizing. And that devotee, you know, he was every day at Mangalarti, at the temple before Mangalarti, chanting his rounds with the devotees there next to Srila Prabhupada. He was doing a vital service every year, an important service for the community. And he left his body in the holy dham, in Mayapur dham, in the association of devotees. So, but at the same time, he was doing all these crazy things. So it's just, who are we to judge? Who are we to judge what devotees do? Who are we to criticize? Who are we to say that it's bad? Because when a devotee surrenders their life to Krishna, they put their lives in Krishna's hand, and everything that Krishna does is good. So when things like that happen, when devotees seem to be doing sinful things or disgraceful things, instead of criticizing them, we should try to see Krishna's hand in what's going on and see that maybe perhaps we can learn something from it, like those instructions that we learned from Lord Brahma's fall down. And that beyond that, that maybe it has a very important purpose that Krishna's trying to achieve by putting the devotee through that, either for the devotee himself or for others, for the society as a whole. And because we live in the association of devotees, if we spend our time just criticizing devotees, then we're misusing the Sangha. And if we do that, we may end up like Devahuti. So the second verse is about Devahuti. And I want to link this, because Devahuti, at a certain point of her life, she was lamenting. There's a whole chapter called Devahuti's Lamentation. And what she's lamenting over is that she had the association of this great exalted husband, and she failed to take advantage of his association properly. So when they first got married, she was serving him. She was doing menial service for him while he was doing his meditation and his, you know, his duties as a Brahmin. And then later, he became compassionate on her because she was serving him so much that she was not even taking care of herself. She had become emaciated. She was pale and skinny. Her hair was matted, her natural youthful luster had diminished. And he said, oh, my poor wife, you know, she's been serving me so dutifully for all these years, look at her. I should, you know, give her some enjoyment. So then by his mystic power, he arranged that she take bath in Bindusarovara Lake, and all of these heavenly apsaras came and they did a whole makeover on her. And she came out, you know, glowing and glamorous, and her youthfulness and her beauty and health was restored. And then he created this aerial mansion, this flying city, which was equipped with all material comforts, everything for enjoyment. And then they spent hundreds of years just traveling through the heavenly planets and all the beautiful places in the universe, engaging in, you know, pastimes, pleasure pastimes. And then after that, they came back to the cottage, and it's described that they simply engaged in sexual enjoyment for 100 autumns. They spent 100 years only absorbed in sex life. And at the end of that period, then Kardama Muni impregnated Devahuti with 9 daughters who were born on the next day. And as soon as they were born, Kardama Muni said, okay, bye. I'm going now. I'm going to take sannyas. And he started walking away. And at that moment, Devahuti, she was like, she realized who her husband was. That, my God, my husband is this transcendental personality. And although we've enjoyed so much together, he's completely detached. He's so absorbed in consciousness of the Supreme Personality of Godhead that he's just going to leave me and his beautiful daughters that are just born and go and meditate on the Lord. And her lamentation was that all this time that we spent together, I was just thinking about my sense gratification, and I failed to take advantage of him for the sake of my own liberation from material bondage. After hundreds of years of associating with a pure devotee, I'm still just as attached to material life as I was when I entered into this relationship. What am I going to do now? I missed this opportunity. And so she expresses this to Kardama Muni, and he says, okay, don't worry. I'm going to give you a son. And this son is going to be very special. It's going to be an incarnation of the Supreme Personality of Godhead. And he is going to preach to you. He's going to explain to you all the things that I could have explained to you, but didn't, because you never really asked. And you never really seemed like you wanted to know. So he gave her Kapila Muni. Kapila Muni was born. And then we have, you know, so many chapters of Bhagavatam, which comprised the instructions of Lord Kapila Dev to his mother Devahuti. So in this way, she became free from material bondage, and she got liberation. But it's interesting that it wasn't until Kapila was going to leave that she actually realized, oh no, I missed the opportunity. So here, in our community, Raman Reti community, we have many senior devotees, very exalted devotees, who just as Kardama Muni was capable of giving his wife the Supreme Personality of Godhead as a child, many of these devotees are capable of giving us bhakti. We know that bhakti is not something that we can achieve on our own. It can only be given by one who has it. So we have the luxury, the great opulence of having many devotees in our association who have been faithfully serving Srila Prabhupada for decades, for 40, 50 years, and who are highly advanced transcendental personalities who can give us bhakti and nurture our bhakti and help us so much in spiritual life, and who sadly, and forgive me for saying this, but it's just a fact, who are sadly soon going to be leaving us, just as Kardama Muni was about to leave Devahuti. So we shouldn't be in that position of lamentation that, oh no, such and such is leaving the planet, and I failed to take proper association of that person. I failed to inquire from them about the absolute truth, about their realizations, about, you know, their associations with Srila Prabhupada and their services that they've done over the years and the deep realizations that they've had from that, how they've overcome so many obstacles in spiritual life, obstacles that I will also have to cross over. How am I going to get the strength to overcome difficulties unless I learn from those who have already walked the path and overcome them? So we need to take advantage of this association. And when we come into the association of devotees, we shouldn't focus on what devotees are doing wrong. Of course, in any community, there's going to be all kinds of wacky stuff going on. But like I said, we should try to see Krishna's hand in all of it and see how everything that Krishna does is good, and everybody's got things they have to go through, and they're all learning experiences for all of us. And instead, we should focus on getting positive association, learning from devotees about how to really progress in spiritual life. Okay, so there are 15 minutes left for questions, comments, so I'll stop there.
Thank you very much for your class. It's obvious that it's coming from a very deep insight and realization. It was very intelligently delivered, and I'm sure all the devotees appreciated it as much as I did.
Thank you.
With regards to these obstacles that Krishna puts in our path, we should see them as stepping stones. We are confused and discombobulated by the circumstances at the time, but there are opportunities to find how it is that I'm supposed to utilize this obstacle, this problem, and glorifying Krishna's presence in it. And so by accomplishing that rhinoceros, Krishna glorifies our own selves. And you presented this class very nicely again. I have to extend my appreciation. Thank you.
Thank you for your nice comment.
I also really appreciate the point that you brought up, you know, about things that people go through and how it can hasten their purification. Bhava Mangal Thakur is a great example of that. Mm. People would have been like, oh, he did this and he did that. But he ultimately became a pure devotee. At the same time, like I just read a letter recently where Prabhupada, this devotee Ram Roy, an early devotee, he'd come back to the temple, and he had left because he wasn't, you know, following, he wasn't so serious. And Prabhupada was glad to see him, welcome him back, but he said, if you can't be serious, then you shouldn't stay, and he ended up leaving. So I think both things are there. It's like, you know, if you see devotees doing things, sometimes they can create offenses, like you take a vow to follow principles, you don't follow them. Sometimes it can cause people to leave permanently. So I think also part of being in a community, the Sangha, is trying to help each other and preach to each other and, you know, try to elevate each other too, right?
Yeah. Yeah, definitely. I mean, it's like I said, we shouldn't use it to justify our own behavior. And also when we see devotees doing things which may be sinful, breaking regular principles, or, you know, just kind of deviant from the path of devotional service, then, you know, while we shouldn't criticize them, at the same time, we may want to keep a safe distance because we may not be in a position to help them, and we don't want to be dragged down by them while they're going through that, because it can be dangerous for us.
And Prabhupada mentioned, like, you know, someone hears, you shouldn't do this, and they don't do it, you know, like, they're out in the street and I get hit by a car. And someone else, they see someone else getting hit by the car, so they don't go in the street and do it. Mm-hmm. Someone else has to get hit by the car. So, again, the more we hear about the right way to act and what repercussions may occur if we don't, that can save us a lot of experience. You know what I mean? Yeah, the hearing is, in some sense, is an experience. If we hear it and internalize it, we may not have to do it.
Yeah.
So that's the reason for Bhagavatam class and how, you know, how important it is. But again, thank you, because the idea that sometimes things happen that, you know, ultimately help people. So it's all there.
Yeah. Yeah. And we can also learn from other people's bad experiences if we're intelligent. Because that's kind of what a lot of the Bhagavatam is. You know, there's many pastimes in the Bhagavatam where great personalities are just doing silly things. And it's all there for us to learn to not do those things. Something else?
Hare Krishna. Thank you. You made so many nice points. I wish I had brought my notebook. So I'm afraid I will forget things. Well, one thing, I wanted clarification about something afterwards, but first I wanted to say on that same point about not criticizing devotees, reminded me of a story Ratadraja Maharaj spoke of when he was here one time, and it was an example that he gave of when someone goes to visit a family, and there's one child, everyone's sitting at the table and they're all eating ice cream or whatever, mm-hmm. and there's one child who's off in the corner and he's not getting anything, and so the person can look at that one child and think, oh, what's wrong with these parents, why are they mistreating that child, and so on and so forth. But the problem is they missed that before they arrived, that child had done something, you know, hit his sister or whatever, something that that warranted his being treated in that way. Mm-hmm. And so, yeah, so the point was just remembering that we don't necessarily know the whole picture. We don't know what Krishna knows. And yeah, just keeping that. Oh, and being careful about not becoming too sentimental in the defense of that child. We have to be loving, yes, but loving doesn't necessarily mean that we have to be very sentimental to the point where we're angry at the other party, along things like that. And then the other thing was, I just wanted a clarification about Lord Brahma. So his body remained intact, and from that body came Swayambhuva Manu and Shatarupa?
Yeah, it was kind of an expansion. He expanded himself. Thank you for your comment, that was very good.
Thank you for your nice class, Mataji. So, you talked about, you know, observing in a community of, you know, devotees or senior devotees also that maybe doing something, let's say, inappropriate or against the principles of Krishna consciousness. We living in a community, the general principle is that we should try to help each other. Mm-hmm. But also, according to scripture, that, like some of our acharyas says, that if we say something about someone that is correct, we have sinful reaction to get. We have, you know, we have to suffer for that. So, how do we balance that situation by hearing about or seeing some devotees that may not do something correct? Would it be advisable to advise them about it or give your opinion, whether, of course, we have different categories of senior, equals, juniors, and so forth. But living in a community, as what you also said, that sometimes Krishna put different personalities to act in ways to show us that we shouldn't act in that way. Mm-hmm. So in that sense, they are special because they are so special that Krishna is using them in that way. But on a general rule, how do we balance like all those different sides and see things, because our nature is also to see things and talk about it or to, you know, try to correct as we may think that, well, we're trying to advise, or in deep within us we might have a critical mentality that we're actually criticizing with all its truth. And so, in other words, there are so many different angles. So how can one justifiably live in such a situation, yeah. Especially being in a community.
So one thing as far as advising or criticizing or talking about it, unless we are in a position where we are obliged to do so, we should probably just not enter into it. I mean, if you are the parent of the person, if you're the spiritual master of the person, or if you're the ashram leader or a temple president, or, you know, the direct authority of the person, then you're obligated to talk to the person about it, like, hey, what's going on here? You know, I heard about this, or I observed this, you know, what's happening and how can I help you? Like that. But if we're not in any of those positions, then we really should just, you know, we can reflect on it within ourselves, try to, like I said, see Krishna's hand in it. What is Krishna doing? Why is this happening? See what we can learn from it in our own spiritual lives. And observe austerity of speech. Like Krishna says in the Bhagavad Gita, that austerity of speech means to speak words that are truthful, pleasing, and beneficial. And also to regularly recite Vedic literature. So it may be true, like you said, you know, if it may be true, but just because it's true doesn't mean you should talk about it. We have to see, is it pleasing? Is it pleasing to the association? Is it pleasing to the person that I'm saying it to? And if someone comes up to me and they just tell me a lot of things, like, tell me about, you know, a devotee's fall down or a devotee's, you know, problems, it's not really what I would like to hear. You know, it's not pleasing to me. I think it's not pleasing to most devotees to hear criticism of other Vaishnavas. And is it beneficial? Probably not. Because generally it gets into the mode of gossip, which is just really degrading and destructive to the community. And it makes it all the much harder for that devotee to get on their 2 feet again after going through a difficulty. So while it may be true, probably in many cases it's not pleasing and it's not beneficial, so we should just stay quiet and get on with our service and leave it up to Krishna and devotees who are obligated to deal with it. Let them deal with it. Okay, does that answer?
Hari Bol Mataji, I don't want to say thank you for a good class. I want to say thank you for a great and inspiring class. And please do not become embarrassed, but I beg that you'll give me just a drop of some mercy, that if I have to speak something anywhere, I'll have this kind of concentration and focus and insight. So please don't be embarrassed, but I'm asking that you give me your Vaishnavi Kripa, that if I have to speak anywhere, that I'll also be able to be so focused. One point, why Bhagavan makes the material creation, Jiva Goswami Pad is mentioned. This is also one lila of Bhagavan, Srishti lila. Mm. And in this creation lila, Bhagavan can perform pastimes that he does not perform in the spiritual world. Mm-hmm. For one example, I'll give two examples. One example is Jayant Vijay. Jiva Goswami Pad says they used to speak while they were guarding the gate of Vaikuntha about the glories of the power of Lord Narayan. Mm-hmm. But then they talk, but we've never seen it in action. We see so many opulences, but there's no fighting in Vaikuntha. Mm. So how will see this pastime? Because of that, and the Lord is taratmik, his heart is one with his devotees, he understood their desire. So in Krishna Sandarbha, he mentions, Jai Vijay Sanakari Sabhya Jema Swa Bhakti Vinodaya Virarase, to feel Viraras, the power of fighting and enjoying his devotees, he allowed them to come as Hiranyakasipu, etc., etc., to taste this pastime, because it doesn't happen in Vaikuntha. Mm. Similarly, in Krishna's lila, in Braj, Krishna generally never leaves Vrindavan. And in the uppercut Braj, that is a fact. He never takes one step out of Vrindavan. But in Prakut Braj here, he literally goes to Mathura and to Dwarka to perform that pastime. So the relationship between the Lord and his devotees is always based on meeting and separation. Mm-hmm. And I'm not going into detail, but one kind of separation is called sudur pravas. It means when the Lord goes to a great distance for a long time and he comes under the control of others. So when Krishna goes to Dwarka, that's what it's like. But that gives rise to a very special kind of meeting. Like when the Vrindavasis met Krishna at Kurukshetra, it is now called Samridhiman Sambodh. It's like any husband and wife, when the husband goes to work and he comes home, there's some separation. But when he comes home at night, there's happiness and things go on. But if the husband will travel for work for 3 years to a foreign country, and you can only communicate by phone, when they arrive at the airport, what is your feeling like? So this sudur pravas doesn't happen in Aprakat Braj. It only happens here. So for this reason, Bhagavan performs pastimes here. Now the hope is, he mentions in 10th canto, anugrahaya bhaktanam manushinam deinavastita. By performing these pastimes with my devotees, people will hear about it. And all the conditioned souls who live here, hearing about it, they will then want to practice bhakti. So he does two things simultaneously, as you mentioned.
Krishna is very expert at doing many things at once. Okay, thank you all very much for your kind attention and your nice comments and questions. Grantaraj Srimad Bhagavatam ki jai, Srila Prabhupada ki jai, Nitya Gaur Premanandi.